Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program, smart ideas.
What if we actually surveil the police? Do we have a right to spy back?
Technology plays a huge role in our relationship with cities, from simple things such as being able to pay for your subway ride with your phone, to more serious efforts such as using drones to help keep protests peaceful. Also ahead.
We do a lot and we'll continue to do more because I think we got it right with everybody else across the legacy company. And I think it's a massive success story for Great Britain to talk about.
Turning London's Olympic legacy into a technology and innovation campus. An electric car sharing scheme changing mobility in the Balkans. An app making life easier for tenants in shared buildings. And another helping people to navigate Brazilian bureaucracy. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Olympic parks like those in Rio and Beijing often fall into disrepair once the Games are over, but London's Olympic quarters are often considered one of the more successful redevelopments around the globe. In 2012, Here East took over the Press and Broadcast Centre from the London Games and turned the site into a technology and innovation campus. It's now home to the likes of BT Sports, UCL Bartlett School of Architecture and Ford Europe. Earlier, I caught up with Gavin Poole, who was the visionary for the site and the bid for the buildings back in 2012, to talk about some of the smart ideas coming from Here East and what Japan can learn from London once their 2020 Olympics have passed.
We wanted an economic legacy and an education legacy and an employment legacy. And I think from our point of view, what we could see all along was London is fragmenting in a nice way, not in a dangerous way, but it's fragmenting and there's different pockets of opportunities around the core of London. If you look at where people come in, whether it's King's Cross or Euston or Paddington or Waterloo or Victoria, they all come in and then they go somewhere from that point. Stratford is now, I think, the second busiest terminal in London, sixth busiest terminal in the UK. A lot of people come into that place. And we just saw this as an amazing opportunity to do something different in East London. Everybody thought it was really a long, long way out. I think the Games was our biggest marketing campaign, which we paid nothing for, the taxpayer paid loads for, because over 8 million people were coming to the park. And they saw how easy it was to get out to Stratford. And if you think about where Canary Wharf, and everybody's comfortable going to Canary Wharf, we're due north. We're not further east. We are literally due north, and we're only just a little bit further east than King's Cross. So when you look at it on a map, I think it was just the way that, you know, our worst enemy is the tube map. You look at the tube map, it looks, it's way out, but it's not, and it's really accessible. And what we find is when people come to us for the very first time, often we hear, wow, this is amazing. And secondly, it really didn't take me that much time at all to get out from central London. You know, and we're there 15, 20 minutes and you're at Stratford and then we've got a beautiful shuttle bus, which we've got in.
Well, actually, working in London over 30 years, you know, first of all, everyone used to live in the west to try and find them cheap in the west of London. Then they came a little bit further east and further east. Yeah. And now definitely people, when they're renting or trying to look for a home, the proximity to the Olympic Park is a real appeal for people to take a home here in London. Your project has helped remap the city in a really interesting way.
I think so. I mean, we've got about 4,500 people now on site, which just saying that puts a smile on my face because, you know, it's only a couple of years ago we were about 1,500. We have a lot of international businesses with us and a lot of international employees and students who are based with us as well. And what we often hear as companies are looking to make a decision about where they are going to go next, whether it's a new office as opposed to a replacement office or whether it's a new product they want to develop out, every company that we see come to Here East, pretty much everyone, has grown. Whether it's the might of Ford Automotive with their global smart mobility team, who have gone from 30 people to over 230 people in the space of 2 years, or whether it's Matches Fashion, who have kept their headquarters in the Shard as a signature HQ, but all of their creative studios, photographic video studios, their in-house design and technology teams are now all over, and they've grown extensively at Here East. The universities have grown. BT Sport has grown. What we're now seeing is from the startups who are based in our own innovation centre, Plexal, which the person who helped me put all the vision together, two of us, Andrew, who runs Plexal. We've got two or three companies in there, three founders, you know, a bunch of cash, start a company. Now they're at 40 or 60 people, and now they're moving in out of an innovation centre, so like a co-working managed office, into what I'd call a more traditional property play of taking a lease from the bigger Here East entity and having their own studios. And we're seeing just growth everywhere we look. We just see growth. And to sort of fuel that growth is the people who are coming to Here East to work for them.
Just to me on the Stratford, let's talk about that now then. How does that fit into this whole network?
So our nearest transport hub and the development post-games is obviously the Stratford as a nucleus. And we're very proud that within the Olympic Park, we actually sit in Hackney and we're adjacent to Hackney Wick and Fish Island was very, very creative. And we wanted to tap into that creativity. And there's a whole load of work that we've done by helping businesses that were in danger of being displaced through regeneration. So we end up in that whole, again, overused word of gentrification. But we've built a whole load of studios where about over 75% of people in there have come from Hackney Wick and Fish Island. So we've managed to retain that creativity on site. But the Stratford side, again, that's gone through an amazing change around. About 5 years ago, people wouldn't even come to Stratford from a commercial point of view, from a business point of view. Now what we often hear from some of the larger potential occupiers is, oh, well, you know, we'd come to Here East, but you're not in Stratford, meaning you're not going to Lendlease or you're not the IQL development next to Westfield, the big shopping centre. And that's been a complete turnaround in 5 years. And, you know, we've solved that because actually our offer is completely different and we work in partnership anyway. So there has been a complete turnaround in the fortunes of Stratford. Now, there's more to do. And I think, you know, any of your listeners who do know Stratford, there's often a big worry with the legacy company, with Newham Council as well, around the divide between old and new Stratford. And I think there's a lot of work that we can all do with working with the University of East London, working with the local colleges, making sure that when we are running insight programmes, which we do to bring in young people to understand the sectors they could have an opportunity of getting into at Here East, is to work further afield. The other side of the railway lines, you know, often use expression, but it's true, there's a massive railway line to the other side into Old Stratford Town to make sure the opportunities are seen over there as well. It's a real divide and that needs to be still broken down.
And just tell me finally, we have the games coming up in Tokyo, we're going to be going to Los Angeles. How much are you now used as a benchmark? How many visitors are you guiding around? Certainly less muddy fields these days, but certainly around a fascinating project.
We do a lot and we do it on behalf of UK PLC. We really do. You know, we believe in our country and believe we absolutely got this right. We're in the middle of making a film with the IOC, looking at the success of the Broadcast Centre and what it's done. We have had multiple visits from the Governor of Tokyo, Mayor of Tokyo and Japanese politicians. We've had the mayor, deputy mayor of LA and the whole team from 2028, the fence should be over for 2024. So we do a lot and we'll continue to do more because I think we got it right with everybody else across the legacy company as well, who are doing a huge job in the whole of the park. And I think it's a massive success story for Great Britain to talk about.
Gavin, thank you so much for joining us here on The Urbanist. You can find car sharing schemes in many cities around the world. Some places even have a fair number of electric vehicles. But Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana, is a rarity. It combines the two. The Avon2Go system is an increasing part of the city's mobility mix, with hundreds of cars and scores of locations. It goes the extra mile for its users. Monocle's man in Ljubljana, Guy Delorni, is one of them.
Electric car on road so dark, to change the end, rewrite the start.
Welcome to Ljubljana. You'll just have to excuse me a moment. I'm choosing which car I'm going to drive today. Should it be the BMW i3? Nah, a bit too flash. Smart for two? There's a problem. I've got three passengers. Renault Zoe. Now we're talking. All it takes is a swipe of the app. And the car is mine. I don't own a car, and I don't want to either. It's altogether too much hassle and expense, and that's before you get into the environmental part of the equation. So, the Avon2Go system is made for people like me. It's low in cost, high in convenience, and scores a great fat zero on emissions.
Electric.
One of the most important pillars for us is mind shifting and education. Before we started to sell anything, we create the concept of how to create mind shift.
Matej Cher is the founder of the Slovenian rental company Avant Car.
He started Avant to Go in time for Ljubljana's stint as European Green Capital 3 years ago.
I read about the initiative about the Green Capital. Mm. This is somehow we can participate to the city in the right moment with the right product. And I knocked on the door and I can say that we got great support, and all the dialogues we had were in the way how to make mobility cleaner and smoother within the city.
What do you think other cities can learn from the Avant to Go experience? Obviously, you're hoping to expand regionally, but I guess, you know, somewhere like, you know, Paris, London, that's maybe beyond what you feel that you want to do.
Our ambition or vision is not to be biggest or to make billions, but to change the world, yeah, in the smart way and to enjoy it. So first step is like Croatia, so to do it internationally first in the region. Ljubljana, Slovenia, Croatia is our laboratorium where we learn how you can provide mobility as a service for the smaller cities and even maybe rural areas in order to be sustainable. So once we reach this point, we feel we are able then to teach other parts of the world about it. Electric
car, the new. Not so long ago, driving an electric car was the sole preserve of a certain kind of nerd. Let's take a ride in an electric car to the west side in an electric car. These days, it's not even the future. It's happening right now. And with many forward-thinking transport projects, Ljubljana is in the lead. This is a city which revolutionised its urban environment by prioritising buses, bikes and walking. Deputy Mayor Tjaša Fitsko is one of the masterminds.
Avantcar, actually, they came to us with the idea of having 100% electric cars, and we were really up for that idea for two reasons, I think. First of all, because it's electromobility. We adopted our electromobility strategy back in 2013, so it was a good thing for us because of less emission, less noise. Another important reason was that it's also a good example of sharing economy with many or more Avant to go cars in the city. We have less other private cars and less crowd in the city.
Why does Avant to Go work? There are plenty of rental locations with protected parking places, and a logistics team whizzes round making sure that all of them have cars available. Plus, the prices are ridiculously reasonable. But don't just take my word for it. Here's another satisfied customer.
My name is Nate Novak. I'm the founder of Novak Law, which is a law firm established in Ljubljana. We use Avant to Go as one of the main means of transportation for the whole company, meaning all our employees who need to go for a business trip, a meeting in Ljubljana or in the area, they normally use Avant to Go's. It's well spread around the city, and the stations are in locations which make sense. It makes our administration much easier. Everyone knows where the cars are, and we have zero admin work with our trips around Ljubljana, which is a great thing. Let's take a ride in
an electric car. The ambition of Avant to Go is to persuade people that car ownership is a concept which should be consigned to the dustbin of history. Well, it certainly works for me. For Monocle, in an electric car in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay. Come on and take a ride.
Is there such a thing as a good drone? And can they be used to promote democracy and accountability in cities? This is the core of some of the research by Austin Choi Fitzpatrick, who's a professor of peace studies from the University of California, San Diego. And his findings are collected in the upcoming book, The Good Drone: How Social Movements Mobilize Action, Democratize Surveillance, and Demand Accountability. It's quite a long title. In it, he delves into the ethical questions too, and how civilian use of drones can aid social movements and protests. So what role does this emerging technology have in our cities? Monocle's Carlotta Rabello had a chance to catch up with Austin in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago. Let's listen in.
The argument I make in the book is that when I wrote the book, which was, you know, these things take a while to get to press, but when I wrote the book, the only conversation that we were having at a national level was about either drones used by the military and drone strikes, which is not what I'm writing about. I'm writing about sort of smaller platform drones. I'm writing about drones that, you know, made by DJI and Parrot and these sorts of things. The sort of quadcopters that we tend to have seen over the last 5 years or so. And I was disturbed that all of the conversations focused on either police, you know, government entities using drones and fears of governmental surveillance. I share those fears. Or Amazon's going to be able to deliver packages in 22 minutes or less or your money back. And that sort of concern over where these corporate drones would fly, right? So those are two important conversations, surveillance and privacy issues related to both, you know, law enforcement in particular, but government and also corporations. Missed in that conversation, I thought, was a whole lot of pro-social use by civil society actors, people who are using drones for things like monitoring police abuse or documenting environmental degradation or identifying like where it was that endangered species were being poached, this kind of thing, right? So my sort of a team, I have a research lab that does work on this called the Drone Lab, and we analyze everything from 2009 to 2015, all the small drone flights that took place. We found out that a small fraction was actually for surveillance. Small fraction was sort of for violence and dropping drugs into jails and that sort of stuff. And the majority, vast majority of the use was for R&D, it was for science, it was for advocacy purposes. I'm a social movement scholar, it was used by people in my world. And so I'm trying to broaden the conversation. Rather than close down a very important and very real conversation about police surveillance, I'm trying to broaden it to ask, well, what if we actually surveil the police? What if we surveil, do we have a right to spy back? And I think that's, I don't have the clear answer to that, but I want to push the debate out from, oh no, here comes the police drone, to, well, what if we the people had drones? What would we do with them? And how do we use them responsibly? And we may decide nobody should have drones. I'm okay with that. But I want to at least have that conversation.
In terms of the research that you've done while working on this book, I remember reading something about violence and overcrowding, for example. What were some of the findings you had on that? Was it that actually helps with crowd control, or that as protesters you can be more prepared when you know exactly what scenario you're going to face before you go onto the street, exactly speaking to police brutality, for example?
So what we did when we actually, my team, used drones in the field is we used drones to document the size of protests. And so it turns out that protest size is a great sort of indicator of whether or not there's broad support for or against a public policy, for example, or for or against a leader or some particular social, political, or economic issue. The big question ends up being how many people turned out on the street. And so what ends up happening is, of course, the person who's been challenged says there were a handful of people on the street. And the protester said, we were in the millions. And the truth is somewhere in between. Journalists oftentimes end up being the sort of arbiter of how many people turned out, but journalists are on the ground also talking to people and reporting and don't know how to count crowds, you know, aren't trained in this way. I shouldn't say don't know how, but like this isn't their formal job. And so what ends up happening is there's this tug of war about the truth. And so my team and I developed this way, this transparent way of estimating how big a crowd is. You know, I don't want to bore you with the details, but it's transparent and both parties can look at it and you can fight over the methodology rather than fighting over the optics. And so it's my move not to sort of like score one for social movements, but to score one for social science and say, well, let's just get the facts out there. And maybe if there weren't a lot of people, then maybe this didn't have that much support. I've gotten pushback on this when I've given, you know, and presented these findings, especially from the left and from social movement folks who say how many people turned out shouldn't be the metric. It's actually the argument and whether or not it's pro-people and whether or not it's ethically right and that sort of thing. And I don't disagree with that from a sort of a ethical normative perspective. But from a public policy perspective, we know that when lots of people turn out on the street, significant numbers, and not numbers, but percentages, when a big percentages of people turn out on the street, they win. And so I'm trying to give back a methodology, for example, or a tool or a strategy so that we can have this conversation, I think, in a more transparent and auditable way around protests, protest size, turnouts, that sort of thing. But the challenge is there were 600 women's marches last year, 1,000 climate, you know, sort of rallies last year on one day. And so then the puzzle becomes, how do we map all of that? So it's great we're getting this stuff, you know, crowd counting is getting this onto one spreadsheet. They're doing like an amazing job. How we take that next step is incredibly challenging just because we're living in a protest society. I mean, this is like the news every day, and these protests will not be going away over the next 5 to 10 years.
Austin Choi Fitzpatrick speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Ribello in Washington, D.C. His new book Here we go. The Good Drone, how social movements mobilise action, democratise surveillance and demand accountability, is out in early 2020. Now to a company making life easier for tenants. Spaceflow is a tenant experience app aiming to make life easier for people living and working in shared buildings. From booking a yoga class to reporting a problem with the plumbing and even organising a block party, the app aims to connect users with both their community and their landlords to make a smoother and happier home for all. Well, Monocle's David Stevens caught up with Spaceflow's CEO and founder, Lukas Palich, to find out more.
The aim is to provide like a digital layer for the building environment, which is also something that is completely natural for our generation to be connected through our mobile phones, right, or like web application quite easily in real time. And similar way, like you use Spotify to listen to music or Netflix to watch movies, I think there is a missing element to get connected to your building as well. In this way, we provide a scalable platform that you can use in any type of asset, from commercial, residential, co-living, co-working, student housing, and you can easily launch the basic core modules focused, like I said, on communication aspect, booking services. I think it also goes along with the fact that it starts with the end user, the occupant, employee in the building, who has totally now different expectations from the environment. And this is something that is reflected in what the company needs from the environment, which means obviously like the nice fit out and nice location of the building or the workspace. And this is, I think, where we are shifting from the way that it was totally like responsibility of the company. Now, when this is a partnership also with the landlord, and landlords are there to also help those companies to attract these talents. And for that, they need this kind of support to provide the best experience for them.
And so is this almost about recreating the entire app world into a community? Because, I mean, you have these things for the wider world, but is it about bringing those things into a smaller housing community?
Exactly. Like, it's super important. We might have a global solution, but we solve a local problem, right? And Spaceflow is, for this way, very like local targeted for the building environment. We do have some cases actually for the whole district, where we, for example, connect 10 offices or 10 buildings together, where you have the vibrant community around this whole area. But mainly it still is very locally approached, and that's the problem we solve in this way.
And I'm sure there's more tenants than there are landlords listening. I imagine the landlord has to be engaged for the tenant to be engaged, but how can just anyone who's a tenant and wants to be engaged with Spaceflow, how can they do that?
What we are now actually working on is to enable these basic core models to be launched through our website. That means that you as a resident, for example, in some student housing or a build-to-rent or any like residential complex, you can actually be the one who can initiate this, and you can launch the platform for a community, right? So like you mentioned, like anyone who thinks this is the right approach for their community, for their building, can reach to us and directly launch at least the basic core models in a quite easy and seamless way.
The CEO and co-founder of Spaceflow, Lukas Palich, speaking to Monocle's David Stevens. The key to innovation is to make life easier, and the city of Sao Paulo has taken that literally in its latest move towards a smart city. Descomplica, or uncomplicated in English, is the city's latest program working to streamline Brazil's usually complicated bureaucracy. It may sound simple, but it's had a huge impact on Paulistano's quality of life by cutting down time spent on filing paperwork, for example. Monocle's contributing editor, Sheena Roster, takes a look into the technologies that are uncomplicating Brazil's infamous bureaucracy in Sao Paulo.
If there's one thing Brazilians like to say about Sao Paulo, it's that everything works here. Now, that statement is true by Brazilian standards, but compared to other global cosmopolitan hubs, Sao Paulo is still buried in a mountain of Brazil's famous bureaucracy. And with over 12 million people living in the city proper, getting all those papers filed and stamped, well, it can get complicated. To put the bureaucracy into context a little bit, here's an example. According to the World Bank, a medium-sized business in Brazil spends around 2,000 hours a year filing taxes. That makes Brazil by far the world leader when it comes to paying taxes. And that's just one example of one area of Brazil's famous bureaucracy. Daniel Annenberg is a Sao Paulo city councillor and the municipal secretary for innovation and technology for the city. It's a role that he's held for almost 3 years, and he's been in charge of implementing Descomplica in Sao Paulo. He tells me the concept behind the new program.
Porque em cada prefeitura regional da cidade de São Paulo, e são 32 prefeituras regionais,
Secretary Annenberg tells me that Descomplica is based on a state system that was implemented several years ago, poupa tempo, or save time in English. The idea is to have one space where paulistanos can deal with multiple municipal taxes and other paperwork. At Descomplica, over 250 different services are offered. Traditionally, people would have to bounce around from one office to another just to get what they needed done. But the far corners of the city is exactly where the city wanted to set up Descomplica hubs.
O Descomplica SP é o programa que simplifica a vida de quem precisa de carteira de trabalho, bilhete único especial e até de quem procura uma recolocação no mercado.
The program started just over a year ago in the extreme east part of Sao Paulo in São Miguel Paulista. 3.5 million people live in that part of the city alone. And the idea of being in other zones of the city is that it helps the city run itself better. That means less people on the road trying to get to the city center to solve paperwork woes when people can just do it in their own neighborhood. Other Descomplicas have since been opened in the other deep corners of the city, and there are now 4 different hubs set up. In the city's extreme west zone, in the neighborhood of Butantan, the Descomplica hub seems to be like a well-oiled bureaucratic machine. After getting greeted at the door, everyone gets a number. You take a seat, and then people get filed through as their number appears on overhead screens. Once you're called, you can sit side by side with an attendant who's helping you. This is for complete transparency, so people know what's being done with every flick of a key or click of a mouse.
Brazilian bureaucracy is kinda messy.
That's Diego Souza. He's the director of Descomplica operations set up here in the Butantan neighborhood. About 900 people use his services at Butantan every day. Diego says being where people need services has made a huge difference in people's lives.
This helps the quality of life in the sense that we're closer to their houses, we're closer to their workplace. São Paulo, in the extreme of the city, we have a lot of poor population and population which can't make their way to the center of the city, which can't access the service.
Among the people here looking to sort out paperwork is Thomas Kraft, a retired heavy machinery technician. This Descomplica hub is a 15-minute drive from his home.
Ativar as pessoas, eles estão com pessoas novas, tem mais gente, tá certo?
For people like him, Descomplica is miles ahead of where public services used to be in the city. It's clean, he says, and there are a lot of people serving us here. Before, Thomas tells me, there wouldn't be that many people helping you. And if they didn't like the way you looked, sometimes you would never get served or helped. It's really uncomplicating my life, he says. So far, since opening, over 700,000 people have been served. But aside from improving public services for paulistanos, Descomplica is more about improving quality of life and creating more equality in a city that's known for its inequality. Sao Paulo City Council doesn't want to just make this mega city a smart city, but a human city, too. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Prefeitura de São Paulo.
Well, that is all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And we're going to play you out of this week's episode with St. Vincent and Digital Witness. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.